Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here to talk to new teachers. And as I was blow drying my hair in the hotel, I kept saying to myself, do not scare these people. But I do want to speak a little bit of truth today to you about the situation around bullying. And but at the same time, encourage you to think about what's working in your classroom. Perhaps you have a bully-free classroom. What might not be working. In the next hour, which is a very short period of time for us to spend together, I want you to start thinking about your own practices, how your practices may contribute to some low-level subtle bullying in your classroom, how your practices may discourage that types of behaviors. I also want you to think as a citizen, as a good community person, about potentially your worldviews and how your worldviews may conflict with those of the kids in your classroom. So we're going to talk a lot today. It's going to take me a minute to get used to this microphone, but I will. A lot about bullying and the efforts that are underway across this country to try to prevent it. We will never eradicate it, so I'm not going to be one of those keynotes that's going to give you the positive story on we're going to eradicate bullying. Bullying is adaptive in our culture, and especially within the United States, which is a very aggressive and violent culture. So what we do is we want to minimize that. We're going to spend an hour together where I would prefer to have spent many days with you, maybe even 15 weeks long course on, you know, behavior within the classroom. Many of you may have degrees in special ed where you spend many years talking about how to prevent behavior problems in the classroom. Let me contextualize my comments here. My comments are from a scientific practitioner that's been at it for 17 years and was talking about bullying way before the rash of suicides that have unfolded. So I come to you a little bit frustrated with the national attention on it because we've lost many lives way before this year, not to minimize the last year rash of suicides, but we've had many schools, many adults maybe in this room can remember being bullied in their earlier years. So this is not a phenomenon that's new. It is certainly changing and evolving in the 17 years. 17 years ago, we did not have cell phones in the ways that we have them now. We didn't have Facebook. We didn't have MySpace. So my job is pretty darn secure, I have to tell you, because kids are humiliating one another through the use of technology. But I also want to calm you down. As teachers, you're going to see a lot more bullying in your classroom that's not related to technology. So we want to make sure that you have a good behavior plan in place in creating caring communities. So I come to you, and you are much younger, and it's intriguing to see the demographic difference between the new teachers and the Chancellor's Academy. I'm always kind of watching this. And so many of you can probably read that. I cannot read that, but I know the slide. So we've been at it. If in fact, when I'm on, this is my 64th keynote this year, so it's been a busy year in the world of bullying and sexual harassment and dating violence in this country. But what you have to recognize is that I come with a huge team behind me that's somewhat invisible. And so that's many graduate students and undergrads that work in the lab, that are in the schools doing the work to make things possible. We come to you with 17 years of research trying to understand the risk and protective factors of bullying. And this is part of an issue that we're having in this country, is that because of the rash of suicides, teachers and administrators are being bombarded with highly marketed, beautiful packages to address their bullying problem. Many of them are not scientifically based, and I want you as new teachers to be very smart consumers of these packages. I understand you're stressed out, you're new teachers. I don't even want to give you this percentage of you that are clinically depressed in your first 5 years. If you want to know, ask me afterwards for validation. But there's many of you, less so in the state of Illinois as other states. But what I want you to do is to be very, very critical. The same way you're critical of the reading curriculum that's thrown at you. It is not any different in the bullying area. We have 47 states now that have unfunded mandates to implement bullying prevention programs. That's a lot of pressure on your administrators to purchase materials. There are experts coming out of the woodwork who have never, ever conducted a research study on bullying or the dynamics of it and have never really stepped foot in a classroom. On the opposite side, you have retired teachers that somehow think they know how to run a classroom, and they probably do, but can they at a large systemic level address some of those risk and protective factors that we're going to talk about in the next hour. So I come to you not just as a researcher, but also as somebody that's in the throes of the largest randomized clinical trial in this country to prevent bullying. We are funded by the Centers for Disease Control. We're in 36 middle schools in the state of Illinois and Kansas. Is anybody here from Joliet, Danville? Raise your hand. I want to see if any of our schools are represented. Danville? Danville? Middle school? We should talk. Danville's fun. It's a fun little community. Great colleagues there. We're also in every middle school except for one in Peoria. And then we're in Wichita, and we're in 9 schools in Chicago Public Schools. So 36 schools across the state of Illinois and Kansas where we're working with teachers. We just successfully implemented, I didn't say it worked yet, I said we successfully implemented the prevention program, which I'm going to show you a little of. That's a social emotional learning program in a middle school program called Second Step in 18 middle schools with all of the 6th grade teachers implementing 15 weeks of a 50-minute curriculum to address the socio-emotional learning that is so key to a lot of the at-risk behaviors we see that correlate with bullying. We don't know if it worked. Post data is just in with 4,000 kids. You will hear about it. If it doesn't work, it'll be on the news, I'm sure. If it works, it'll be on the news. Everyone's looking at whether or not a socio-emotional learning framework can change bullying in our schools, can decrease it. Or I want to put a little, you know, something in your hat to think about. Perhaps we can't decrease bullying because society in the United States is such, and the ways in which parents are raising their kids and the fact that we're in so much crisis, that maybe a school-based program isn't enough. Okay, so I want, you know, I'm not gonna sugarcoat anything today, but I'm gonna try to make you feel positive about the practices that you're engaging in. Okay. In addition to that, we have tracked 1,600 kids in Peoria as well. Peoria is very open to research, and this is one goal that I hope you'll understand the importance of research. We tracked 1,600 kids in the last 4 years across 6th through 8th grade in Peoria to look at the overlapping risk and protective factors for bullying, sexual bullying, also called sexual harassment, and homophobia. Why? Because as we have lots of people making millions of dollars on the bullying prevention efforts, we want to be able to identify what are those really key risk and protective factors that need to be shifted in order to change the ways in which we think about bullying. And those findings are intriguing, and we're starting to publish some of that and trying to disseminate that to a number of folks out there. Let me give you a shift. As you can imagine, bullying is highly politicized right now, right? Because it's all over the news. Everyone, even your grandparents, understand that bullying is a problem in the schools. And it always hasn't been like this, right? I mean, in 1993, I used to give talks on bullying, and everybody was like, what is she talking about? What is that? Because it was based on this Norwegian guy, Dan Olias, who was talking about whipping boys. And it was mostly this boy phenomenon, thinking it was mostly thugs. In 1997, some of our research uncovered, which was conducted in Georgetown, Illinois, where we sat down and actually had interviews with kids. We learned in 1997 that bullying was quite a popular thing to do, that the popular kids engaged in these behaviors and socialized one another to engage in these behaviors. It's going to be important because I want you to think about your view of a bully, and I will bet that 50% of you have an inaccurate view of that bully. I want you to remember that bullies come in all shapes and sizes. In 17 years, I've now had 3 parents admit that they have raised a bully. 3. You're going to see the numbers. Parents are extremely defensive about this. They will blame you as a teacher for anything that happens in the context of the classroom. So we have to really, really think about how can you create a bully-free classroom? How can you together as a cohort of teachers within your building commit to modeling appropriate behavior? Now, this is going to be key because we have very inappropriate modeling of behaviors on the parts of teachers and administrators in our schools. How can we shift and make a commitment in that way? So let's talk a little bit about what we know about bullying. Now, this is so America, right? United States of America. Bullying has been happening forever. Here's a definition, but guess what? We have no idea of whether or not our definition can ever be realized and assessed. So much so that the Centers for Disease Control 2 weeks ago convened about 12 of us nationally to have a definition consensus conference. I was like, really? 2011. We have proven programs, however, to prevent bullying, proven programs, but yet we don't have a definition. So this should, you should be skeptical. At the same time, can we ever really come up with a definition, given that some kids are more sensitive than others? See, I'm going to speak truth to you here today, that people will not speak. There are some kids that are hypersensitive, and that something that just may look like, I don't want to be your friend, doesn't necessarily constitute bullying. So we've adopted a definition of bullying from European countries, which we still have a fascination with European countries for whatever reason, kind of cool places to visit, you know, a little bit of history. And that definition really does include three components that we're grappling with, right? So we can all recognize that bullying is not normal conflict. Okay? So in your program, how many of you are in a school in which peer mediation is used to prevent bullying? You got 1, 2, 3, 4. Your administrators do not read the literature. Surprise, surprise. Peer mediation is contraindicated in the area of bullying. Tell your administrators that. They'll be like, who said that? And you can say my name and they won't know who I am. It's okay. But I have written in my book that nobody reads in the article that it's, what are you mediating, right? This is an example. What are you mediating? Bullying is nasty behavior. You're targeting someone. There's nothing to mediate. Okay, so we have a recognition that it's somehow different than normal conflict. And we want kids to be able to negotiate normal conflict, right? That we want. In addition, we have some sense, and oh, this was a day-long debate among the experts. Does it have to be repeated? Or can you have a bullying incident that is so traumatic that it doesn't have to happen twice? Now, the definition is going to make a difference for you, because if it's one incident in your classroom and it doesn't happen again, are you going to write it up as bullying? Or if there's one incident and you have seen the definition that has to be repeated, you're going to wait for the next one? Do you see the problem we're having, right? And then the third is that there's a power differential. Right, so we can think about the YouTube. How many saw the YouTube? I was going to show it today, but it made me cry. It made me sad. The YouTube video with the Australian classmates where there was a large child who was being hit by a smaller child, and then finally he had about enough, and he took the small child and just threw him on the concrete floor on his head. Now, that depiction is a myth, right, that somehow that big guy should have defended himself because, you know, he's larger in size. What we know from the power differential definition part of this is what's important is that it can be social. It doesn't have to be physical. In 17 years, I have interviewed some of the biggest victims, and in my mind, I think, why don't you just fight back? Okay, I'm human too, right? If there's a big guy that's being bullied by a little one, why wouldn't you just fight back and use your size? Well, we teach them differently. Of course, Dorothy, that's why. I remember speaking to a K-12 school, because we have these in the state of Illinois, where they're all together in K-12. And I'm looking at the high school kids on this set of the bleachers, and I'm saying, you need to be the role models here. And the senior raised his hand. There's all 12 of them. And he was like, excuse me, doctor, I don't want to be disrespectful, but the small kids bully us. And the fourth graders are going, that's funny. Somehow that's funny. And I was like, wow. And I'm standing in a gymnasium. What kind of expert was I? Right, to assume. So power differential could be athleticism. It could be the cliques that dominate in the school. It could be a new kid that comes to the school. I mean, what's your plan for the entry of your new kids within the context of the classroom? Do you see why we need weeks to talk about this? I haven't even gotten past the definition slide. Do you see? It's okay. All right, I'm going to get through this. So you should recognize from the definition that it can be physical, it can be verbal, it can be sexual. What we do recognize from cyberbullying is that it is the exact same phenomenon. It's just a different medium. Which everybody's like, in psychology, we're like, okay, our theories will apply. We don't have to recreate the wheel. Kids are being nasty and mean and spreading rumors. They're just not writing notes anymore. They're posting it on Facebook. Okay, and I come from a generation where we pass notes. And sometimes they found the notes. Right? Facebook, they find them. It's the same phenomenon. It's just really, really public. So all of those are the different types of definitions. We know that kids also play different roles. And this is a huge body of literature. We're talking about 4,000 articles written on bullying in the last 10 years. Okay? This is where it's at. We do recognize that kids play certain roles. So we have the ringleader bully, and I'm going to keep saying the ringleader bully because it's a group process. The bully victim dyad is a myth. I've written about this quite a bit. Get that out of your head to think it's a bully victim dyad. That may be what you're seeing, but behind that bully is an audience. Behind that bully, they call them henchmen, you know, they're instigators, they keep the fire going. Recognize that if your interventions are simply to expel and suspend the bullies, which we're continuing to do, and you haven't changed the climate that promotes the bully, you will not shift that in your school. Ringleader bullies. We have victims, we have different types of victims. That would be an entire lecture about the different types of victims. We have passive victims that somehow just are beaten down and they just do not even fight back. We have provocative victims. I call these kids, they just have flashing lights on their head. That's how they get their attention. Oh, people do not like when I say that, but you know the ones that are in your classroom. They have a little bit social skills challenges that perhaps they don't know how to join a group, and it's your job to teach them social skills. Okay. We have bully victims, and those are our school shooters. So if you look at the Secret Service report, we find that 75% of the school shooters in the last 40 years actually have been victims of bullies, not the Columbine guys. No. The Columbine shooters, one was clinically oppressed and one was a psychopath. They were not victims of bullies. They were not actually even ostracized. But there's our media to hype up the bullying situation. But we do know that 75% of the school shooters were victims of bullies. That's important to understand when we think about the increasing rates of suicide. What you'll notice is that those increasing rates of suicide, their victims, many of them are much younger. They don't have the capacity to get a gun and shoot up a school. So they attempt and successfully commit suicide. In addition to that, we have a group of bystanders, and those are the kids who are also called allies or upstanders or whatever the terminology is, defenders, non-defenders. They're standing around. Those are the kids that either don't intervene for fear of retaliation on their own part, or they like the show. When we interview kids, bullying and all this drama makes school more interesting. What would they do without all of it? Right? So what is it about our test-driven culture that this is the most exciting thing for them? Being kind of antisocial is exciting. So let's look at the numbers. Many people say, isn't this an epidemic? No, the numbers really haven't changed, but I'll tell you what has changed is the onset of bullying. We are seeing bullying in preschool playgroups. Laura Hainish at Arizona State University started studying preschool playgroups about 10 years ago and was shocked at what they were observing. There's some sociologists that talk about maybe it's perhaps this idea of play dates that's introduced, this idea of who would you like to invite on a play date, right? How many, I just went to the playground and I would interact with the people I wanted to interact with. If you were mean on the playground, I went and played with somebody else. We have moms groups and dads groups and all kinds of groups coordinating the social lives of their kids at a very, very young age. And they learn very quickly that if in fact two moms do not get along, they will not interact with that other mom's son or daughter. Hence, the relational aggression that we're seeing in preschool playgroups. The slide used to say 5th through 8th grade because I felt, rest assured, that bullying did not occur at these high rates until 5th grade. For all teachers, you know that that is exactly not true. These numbers have not changed over time. Again, the demographics of the onset has changed. 15% of our kids are chronically victimized. 17% are your ringleader bullies. 8% are your bully victims. And these are the bully victims. Bully victims have the most serious mental health profile. Bully victims, those kids that have been victimized and then become aggressive themselves, it does not take a psychologist to say that they're probably at risk for some mental health problems. These kids will not benefit from a primary universal program. They need second and tertiary programs, which we'll talk a little bit more about. These kids need a referral to your social worker if you have one, and she's actually available or he's available to work with your children, like social workers should. But oftentimes they have the huge caseloads, so they're putting out fires and managing crises and not necessarily attending to the kids that have mental health issues. 60% of your bystanders, only 13% of these intervene to help the victim. Okay, so that's your profile. That's what we're dealing with in 3rd through 8th graders. By high school, it's sexual harassment and dating violence. As much as the Phoebe Prince issue was framed as a bullying situation, that was sexual harassment and sexual assault. Okay, so let's put it in perspective. High school kids really aren't running around bullying one another. They're definitely engaging in homophobic bantering. They're sexually harassing. And girls are perpetrating dating violence as much as boys in high schools. So bullying prevention is a little bit late in high school. Okay, so cyberbullying, I want to spend not too much time on this because this is not my area of expertise, so I put that caveat out there. And I'm at year 15 in my career, so I'm at the halfway point, you know, knowing the state, who knows what it's going to look like for you guys out there as teachers, but keep it up. So I'm not going to, we need more scholars. So if you guys, you want to get a PhD, you can come study with me and work in our lab and become the cyberbullying expert. I propose that too. I only need a couple of you to take me on there. So cyberbullying, here's a definition. Again, we're in the infancy of this work. It involves the use of information and communication technologies to support. But I'm looking at the, he's like, why are you looking at me, really? It would be you. You're going to help me? Sorry, you. So rude. This is my 64th talk. I've become rude with this tiredness. You do have a name. Mike is going to help me. Yes. So I want to show you this. That I,
It's going to be fuzzy, but hopefully you can just hear, just listen to this public service announcement, and we'll make it available because I want you to show it to your kids.
Hi, guys. Hi. Hi, Megan. Hi, Jessica. Megan, you're a tramp. Ryan Fitch told me you guys made out. Everybody knows. He said your breath smells like garbage. And he almost puked. He says you're the most desperate girl he knows, besides your mom. How many boyfriends does she have anyway? Lots? Your makeup makes you look like a clown. That zit is huge, zit face. Ugly.
Are you in shock like me? I was at a conference last week in Nebraska, and the expert Sherry Bowman showed that, and I was in tears because it just showed exactly the problem around cyberbullying. Right? That's a public service announcement. I had never seen it, so I always wonder about PSAs that I never see, right? You know, I mean, I remember the egg frying and that's your brain on drugs, but I don't remember seeing anything like this. So I think we have to put this in perspective. Show this to your kids. Have a conversation. We'll send you this link. Again, if you just put this, you know, I don't know where it's at, but if you just you find it. Has anyone seen that? Again, what is wrong up with our PSAs, right? So it shows this idea that kids have a disconnect between how they're treating one another and how, you know, online and in these mediums and how it comes across. And of course the mother was just like in shock. And here this was this transparent. It was powerful to me. And, there's lots of PSAs out there, but for that one, I'm going to start using with our kids in schools to have a conversation about that behavior. It's kind of interesting. So what I'd like to do is to spend a very short amount of time just kind of calming you a little bit, given our time here today, and that is that the media selling papers or online papers really getting us hyped up around cyberbullying. What I will tell you is that for administrators, it feels like cyberbullying is a tremendous problem because it takes up a lot of time, right? So you can have a bullying incident that doesn't involve cyberbullying, and most administrators ignore it. I'm just going to tell you, most ignore bullying. They tend to pay more attention to cyberbullying. Therefore, it takes more time. And I say to administrators, I was like, well, if you responded appropriately to bullying, it would take more time, too. Okay. The media is hyping up the statistics. Now, remember in your mind, I'm going to have you do a little bit of work here today, and that is to think about 15% being chronically victimized, 17% being your ringleader bullies. That's 32, 8%, up to 40 are your bully victims, and then all the bystanders, right? So many of the kids play a role. When you look at lifetime statistics, which is often reported in the USA Today and the other magazines that we read or Yahoo.com, you should be alarmed that 10 to 33% of youth ages 11 to 19 have been on the target. That's lifetime. Now, I want to do a poll, like I am USA Today, and I'm the true scientist from the University of Illinois. How many of you have received a rude text message? How many of you have interpreted a Facebook post that was directed toward you that was kind of not so nice? Right, and we could be hypersensitive, but, you know. So, that's the statistics that the media are reporting. Please, please, if in fact we want to be educating generations of our children, and we are, and I'm a teacher too, right, because you're sending me these undergrads, please do a better job than former generations. We have to be better consumers of what the media, what the government's feeding us, because we're in a situation where there's a huge disconnect between science and what we know and what's being pitched to us. And we know this. Everybody knows this, right? Okay. If you look at Illinois middle school students, you actually see that the rates are a little bit more modest. Now, we don't assess perpetration anymore because kids lie. Kids know that they shouldn't be doing this. I love when kids are like, I didn't know. Yes, you do know. Because in the state of Illinois, most of your schools have been visited by the Attorney General's office. These kids know. And if they haven't, you have access to someone, to an attorney general's office, to talk to your kids about responsive use of cyber technology. So let me know if you don't. But you'll see that 15% have received a rude comment in the last year, 7% a rumor spread about him or her, 2% threatened by a student, 11% received the rude text message. Girls are doing this at double rates in the state of Illinois. However, there's going to be great variability depending on your school regulations. How many of you are in schools where they allow kids to have cell phones? There you go. Guess what? You're going to have high rates of cyberbullying. Right? Now, why? Some of you are thinking, why would they allow them to have cell phones? Well, I'll answer that question for you. Because the parents want them to have it, for the most part. What did we do before cell phones? You went to the office and you said, can I use a phone to call my mom? That's what we did. I'm from Virginia, where we had party lines, so sometimes you had to go over to the neighbor's house. We had to get on and say, I need to use a phone right now. We survived. In some of our schools that are affluent, where there's so much pressure on the teachers from the affluent parents, right? Because the parents, sometimes you just want to say, why don't you just teach? Why don't you just come in the classroom and teach? But there's so much pressure that the rules and regulations of a school are being dictated by the parents. And what that means is that there's not enough strong administrative support. We need strong principals and superintendents. I can be in one school in which there's a really bad cyberbullying problem. The prevalence rate's very high. And go across in the same school district, they don't have a problem because they don't allow the kids to have cell phones. They actually use filters on their computer. So we're going to have, as we kind of evolve, we're going to have to continue to grapple with this issue. But you should know that in-school bullying, face-to-face bullying, is much more prevalent than cyber. I also would encourage you to go to the White House. We were at the White House, and there was a panel of researchers. And Patchen is his name. He presented on the cyber issue. And he had two messages for teachers and parents. One, for the most part, kids are doing really responsible pro-social things on the computer. It's a really good thing. Two, if you are a parent and your child gets involved in a cyberbullying incident, the worst thing you can do is take away their phone, because they will never, ever disclose an incident again to you. Right? So how do you negotiate that? And then three, to recognize that it is not an epidemic of cyberbullying that the media is portraying. Should we be in front of it? Yeah. But we've gotten in front of it without the science, without really slowing down and taking a deep breath and putting it in perspective. Okay, hopefully that's clear. I also want to talk to you about something that is a phenomenon that's unfolding in our research. And so what I like about research is that I see it as iterative. As society changes, my research changes, right? I read my articles from the late 1990s. They don't really make a lot of sense now. And so as we were interviewing kids in 93, we did not hear a lot about homophobic bantering at all. Around 99, 2000, the kids started talking about the use of those awful words. I'm going to stop saying this. I used to say them in my talk. Because I want to model appropriate behavior, I'm not going to say that. I wouldn't say the N-word as far as racism. I'm not going to say the F-word related to this. But we noticed that upwards of 35 to 50% of the bullying content in middle school was homophobic in nature. And I remember turning to Paul Petit, my former doctor student, and I was like, what is going on? Right? We thought for sure kids would use these kind of terms, but they didn't really know what it was. They know exactly what they're doing. And let me tell you, in our studies, it's working. Now, let me calm anybody out there that has religious ideas that are thinking, oh my gosh, is she going to talk about homosexuality? No, I'm not. It's okay. I'm not. What I'm talking about is the lack of room for any kind of gender expression that doesn't fit your anatomy. Girls need to behave this way. Boys need to behave this way. When boys don't behave a certain way, then they're the target of these terms, regardless of whether or not you're gay. Many of you can probably remember kids that probably thought they were heterosexual, thought they liked girls, but yet they, what, were nice to girls, maybe a little feminine, maybe had emotions, they were sensitive. So then they're targeted because of gender expression. Now, we have to, if in fact 35 to 50% of the bullying in your classroom is homophobic in nature, if it involves these words, but yet very few of the bullying prevention programs that are going to be sold to you ever talk about it, do you wonder why our bullying prevention programs aren't working? We don't need 15 weeks of curriculum around homophobic bantering. You just need to not allow that language in your classroom. It's just that simple. Don't allow it. But that means don't allow it in the passing of the hallways either. Superintendent, anybody here from Springfield? Love your superintendent. Can't remember his name, but love the man. And he said, it's one of those talks I gave, and he said, I want wholesome language in my school. I don't want students with disabilities, students that have a different gender expression, students that are overweight. I don't want any of them to be targets. I want wholesome language. And I wanted to cry again because I was like, look at that, wholesome language. So let's recognize this is not a sexual orientation issue. And in some levels, you know, we have to be concerned about LGBT issues within education. But as far as bullying, we just need to recognize there's a wide range of bias-based bullying that's happening in our schools. We have an increasing number of victims that are targeted because they're Muslim, because they're from the Middle East. Because they wear head dressings? Okay, so let's just recognize at some level we are very exclusionary. We segregate. I live in Chicago. Oh my goodness, I've never seen a city so segregated in my life. We hide behind our gated communities. The middle class is disappearing. And we're surprised that our kids are being nasty with one another. Our kids are mirroring the adult communities. This is what we have. We will never, ever get rid of bullying if we don't recognize that we're the ones that's the training ground for these kids. And that saddens me. I'm not going to cry today because it's just not good. Mascara, bow down. Not good. So let me unpack this because what I learned in the last, I can't believe I only have this short amount of time with you. Isn't this fun? I love talking to new teachers. It's great. But I'm going back in the classroom in the fall, so come take a class or something. Okay, so I have been called very... I get death threats from the right conservative that think I am pushing a homosexuality agenda. I'm not. Focus on the Family has attacked me many times, and it's not so bad. I don't have security, right? So it's all right. I'm good. Right. They're not chasing me to Champagne. But what I've learned is that in the first 10 years of presenting work and trying to work with teachers and students, what I really learned very quickly is when people walk out of my talks, when I talk about LGBT youth, is that that's probably not the approach, right? I mean, if people are leaving, that's not really nice. I was at a conference last week in Decatur. It's a diversity conference, and I had 3 people walk out on my talk. And it wasn't because they had to go to the bathroom. I confirmed with them that they were not happy with the content. And this is what I was showing them. So I apologize that this is off somehow, but it says openness to friends and schools. So Paul and I, a former doctoral student of mine, he's now at Boston College and really, really doing some great work around making schools more tolerant. We said, okay, we've got to have a different strategy because the people are disengaging once we start talking. Even the LGBT, the acronym, just throws people off. So we did this simple study in Dane County. And I'm going to show you essentially the results. But we asked two questions. I'm going to keep this very simple research. It's the easiest paper we ever published. To what extent would you remain friends with someone if they came out to you? Simple enough. To what extent would you prefer not to attend a school with those lesbian, gay, and bisexual or questioning kids? Two basic questions. Now, I want you to guess what the percentages are in your own head. Anonymous survey, 7th through 12th graders. What are the percentages of this? You would be shocked to find out, and I'm going to show you. About 7,000 in study one, middle school kids, about 13,000 high school kids. Predominantly white sample, this is Wisconsin. We did not get Milwaukee schools in here, so African Americans are not as representative as I'd like, although Milwaukee's starting to sign on to our study. So essentially, I want to show you the results. Look at that, everybody's excited, she's moving fast. Study one, boys reported less willingness to remain friends. So we asked them, how much do you agree or disagree with the statement? To what extent would you remain friends with someone? So boys were less willing. Now I'm going to pick on the men in the room, because actually I'm so happy to see men in a new teacher's conference. This is awesome. Something's happening. This is great. It's good for us, too. You guys come, we get more pay. That's funny. I'm from psychology. It's a feminization of education. Yeah. Okay, does anybody, I want to be brave, young men, why it is that boys would be less willing to remain friends with somebody if they came out? And if I had better eyes, I could read your name tag and call on you. But I'll pick on you. What do you think? Yes, exactly. Number one reason, and most boys, when we present the data back, we actually collect the data in the schools and we present their data back, their hands go up so fast because they're ready to defend the boys that say this. And they say, look, they'll then think I'm gay. There's a second reason they raise their hand. Picking on the old tech guy there. Chris, what do you think? Remember back to seventh grade, your buddy, he's like, I got to tell you. I think I'm gay. Anybody? Come on, guys. Yeah, is that a guy? Yes, my eyes are so bad. Is that a guy? Looks like a guy to me. Yes. Yes, yes, because men, especially early adolescents, a little bit self-centered narcissists, yes. Of course they'd want you, right? Well, luckily, the girls, we're so like the ethos of care, right? We are the ones taking care of everybody, so we're like, okay, that's okay. We also found that students in lower grades reported less willingness to remain friends. So as you age, the high school kids that we talk about, and this is a great way to have a dialogue. I can send you this and talk to your kids about these numbers. And I'm going to show you the numbers, and I know. The suspense is building. But the kids will say, by the 11th grade, you've had a few friends come out. It's not a shocker anymore. So they're, you're like, this is really great science, lady, but really? Okay. So hopefully you can read that, and what you see is by grade 7 through 12, you'll see that the numbers of those kids that agree that I would not remain friends goes down, so this is encouraging. But at the same time, when we look at the 7th graders, 1 out of 3 7th graders said they would not remain friends with someone. This is the environment I'm talking about. This is why those words are used. This is how these words have an influence. Combine that language that we're talking about, that narrows gender expression and penalizes stepping outside of that gender expression. Combine it with the fact that maybe your social support would go away if you came out. Who the hell would come out in middle school? Not me, based on this data. When do kids come out?
They come out in fourth grade. Who do they come out to? You. How many of you feel prepared to deal with, manage a student coming out to you? One. Two. And some are like, maybe. Right? Many of you were not taught about that in pre-service training. Yet another reason to think about the ways in which we make our classrooms more inclusive. And we believe simply by not allowing the language is a good start. How many of you are in schools with GSAs? And for those of you that are like, what is a GSA? I'm going to tell you because I've learned to not assume. Gay Straight Alliance, how many of you have a GSA in your building? There we go. Three. The new GLSEN report actually shows that those schools that have GSAs have less homophobic bullying and bantering. That's a step in the right direction. Is it enough? Not necessarily. But it is a statement, right? And I'll send you information about how to start a GSA if, in fact, the students, it needs to be student-driven. Or if you want me to come to your school and show these data to your kids and have a conversation, then they can build if they're interested in that. Given the suicide, the youth are starting to activate some of these grassroots movements. Okay, how about the percentage of kids that would prefer not to go to school with LGBT youth? One out of two seventh graders in this sample. And we've replicated this. I'm not going to pick on Wisconsin because sometimes I get things on evaluations like, Wisconsin's a great state. I love Wisconsin. It's great and it's great. There's lakes. I got it. We have replicated this all over, right? These numbers look the same in Texas. I mean, you know, come on. So, one out of two would prefer not to be in a school with LGBT youth. Now, what if you were questioning? And these statistics, as those kids in a school do not want them there, guess what goes up? The use of that language I'm talking about. You're marginalizing students. Hence your suicide rate. So what do I say to that? I can send you some links. The Anti-Defamation League has some great material on how teachers can talk about bias-based language. You don't have to recreate this yourselves. We'll make sure that Nancy gets to you the ADL website. GLSEN has great stuff. That's the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, Students Education Network. In addition to that, there's something called GroundSpark that has great videos, one called Straight Laced, and one's called Let's Get Real. Straight Laced is all about stepping outside of the really narrow gender expression. So girls get to get on the video talking about, you know, being really athletic and what would be called a tomboy, and how it is they just want to be able to express a wide range of gender expression. Okay. So we'll make sure that we get you those resources. Let me talk to you for a few minutes about what is not working in our schools and then propose a potential model. When we think about meta-analysis is a statistical technique to summarize a field of literature. For any of you that are going to go on and get your 75 or do whatever, your master's, you want to find the meta-analytic study. This might be the highlight of the day. The meta-analysis will always be the summary, the one article that summarizes everything we know about a body of literature. Right? So if you're doing a paper on adolescent depression, go into PsycINFO or wherever you go, Eric, and type in meta-analysis depression, and you will get probably a few meta-analyses. That's some, hundreds of articles up, right? And it tells us, essentially, in adolescent depression, because they have a better base than the bullying, that adolescent depression is best treated with medication tapered off with some talk therapy. So the meta-analysis show that it summarizes by a big body of literature. Your work is done. In the area of bullying, unfortunately, we do not have a huge empirical base. Your federal government will tell you that we have proven programs for bullying. We do not have proven bullying prevention programs. Many of you have probably heard of the DARE program, have you not? That didn't work either. It doesn't work. We're a DARE community. I see it every time I get off the highway. I think, oh, my goodness, I want to take some eggs. I'm not into vandalism, but I have the thoughts of taking down the sign because we know from the meta-analysis of DARE, DARE did not work. We still have high rates of drugs and alcohol for kids that go through DARE. Just say no didn't work.
Well, in the area of bullying, our federal government saying we have improving programs, and there's folks from Europe that are making millions selling these programs to your school districts. I'm an expert witness on six cases now of kids that killed themselves, and in every case, the school district had these programs in place. They're covered, because the federal government said they're proven, yet the children are still deceased. So what does the meta-analysis show? You should be concerned that on this slide, you'll see that there's only 16 studies in this meta-analysis. We need 11 to even start doing a meta-analysis, and 16 is not that much. We have 80 bullying prevention programs on the books right now, and I've been on the road for a while, so I imagine it's about 100. Haven't stayed on top of all the singing with children, all kinds of former teachers developing programs. You should be very disturbed that there's only 16 studies in this meta-analysis. This one I'm talking about being smart consumers of what you're being sold. Only two of the six U.S. studies are published. So actually we're basing the proven in the United States on two published studies. I don't know about you, but if I didn't publish, I wouldn't have a job across the street. Okay, so the peer review publication, this is what we look to as academics, and this is what you should look to as teachers of data-driven. So when they say, we're going to use the OES bullying prevention program, or we're going to use this prevention program because it's proven and the federal government endorses it, they're endorsing the efficacy in Europe. They're not working in the United States. And I'm going to propose, in the very short amount of time that we have together, propose why. I also want to give you permission to develop your own hybrid behavior plan. Why adopt something that's clearly not working, and in some cases makes bullying worse? It's called iatrogenic effects. It increases bullying because it actually hones the skills of the bully ringleader. So I want you to be smart consumers of that. But in this meta-analysis in 2008, Ken Merrill found that, in fact, there was no impact on bullying behavior whatsoever. No change in the attitudes or behaviors associated with bullying. Let's go to the Farrington and Tofte study, which is a group out of the UK, and upwards now, they have looked at 80 different studies across the world. If you dig deep into the appendices of that study, you will find that not a single U.S.-based study worked. Yet the National Institutes of Justice cites this study as showing that these programs are proven. Now, because remember, I wasn't going to scare you. I was going to tell you something very informative today. And that is, those programs in Europe, if you want to even entertain the idea that we're like Norway or Finland, where they love teachers in Norway and Finland, by the way, love them. They love teachers. They respect teachers. That's the big difference here. I love teachers and respect teachers, and I think everybody should. But it's very different. In those studies, what they do show is that the efficacy is associated with an increase in teachers' knowledge and competence around bullying. And I've said that for 10 years. And when I get real depressed, because I do get depressed too, and want to quit, I say, I think I should just start working with the teachers. Because the students, we're not moving the needle, and we're putting them into context in which the teachers do not feel like they have the knowledge and the competency to intervene. So why not work with the teachers? That's why I was so excited to come here today and talk to you, because you're the new teachers. You're not the other teachers that are going to be like, oh my gosh, another thing on bullying. So if, in fact, we can target the teachers' knowledge and competence, there was an effect in the European countries. In addition, those programs that included multimedia and engaged the kids at their level, these kids are technologically savvy. And I mean all kids, even kids in impoverished neighborhoods, are still engaging in technology. We have some bullying prevention programs that are actually, you need a VCR to use. How many of them? You should see even my Chicago public schools that are a little poor, down the south side. They don't even have a VCR. They have a DVD. Okay, so we have to, how can we engage the kids in this process? We have to be innovative. Playground intervention seems to be working in Europe as well. Those interventions that involve family seem to be working. So we have to think about, what are we doing that is supposedly proven but not really working? What we're doing is we're not allowing really good grassroots movements to come to the surface. To think about different frameworks, to see bullying as co-occurring with other types of behavior. It's not an isolated event. Families are key. In 1993, when we serve, I have this one item. How many of you, I ask kids, how much would you disagree or agree with this statement? My parents say, fight back when I'm hit first. 33% in 1993. What do you think it is now? 78. And I would suspect that a few of them probably aren't telling the truth. But 78%. When you have a retaliatory type of phenomenon that's happening where the parents are saying you need to fight back, you need to maintain your reputation, and parents are saying it's none of your business, don't snitch, and we have all bystander intervention programs out there in communities and subcultures in which telling isn't part of that culture, we have some serious, serious work to do in this area. Nothing's proven. We got a long way to go. So why little success? The majority of these programs fail to recognize that bullying co-occurs. We're finding huge correlations over longitudinal studies with bullying and alcohol and drug use. I'll tell you, if you're using drugs and smoking pot, your personality is a little bit compromised in middle school. If you're hungover in middle school and somebody messes with you, your executive function is compromised and we see aggression within the schools. So let's recognize that, in fact, in middle school, bullying becomes sexual in nature. That's called sexual harassment. We have a Supreme Court decision based around that, that it's not tolerated. How many of you know your Title IX sexual harassment coordinator in your school? You got a long to-do list here, right? There's a Supreme Court decision that shows that all of you should be trained in sexual harassment, and your kids should have sexual harassment curriculum, and you should know who your sexual harassment coordinator is. Not one person raised their hand. We're Title IX non-compliant. As much as you're uncomfortable with that word, sex, because we are, because we're a repressed society. Sexual harassment is against the law, and if your administrators are logging bullying incidents that are clearly sexual harassment, they're going to be in big trouble from the Office of Civil Rights right now. And so we have to recognize that all these things co-occur. Programs often fail to address basic life and social skills. In our research, we know that kids appreciate the knowledge around bullying. They appreciate the definition. They appreciate that they should be the upstander, bystander, but they don't have the skills to do anything that you're asking them to do. A lot of the kids are coming to you with what we call compromised exec function because they have trauma in their history. And we're asking them to sit down and have one-on-one dyadic conversations where they're going to have listening skills and other types of things. They don't have that skill level. And as much as you, especially middle school and high school teachers, feel that you aren't necessarily there to develop those social skills, you are there to develop them because many of those kids are not getting them within the context of their home. And so we have to recognize that they need life and social skills, not just throwing this declarative, not even procedural knowledge around bullying to them. A lot of our work has been focused around the peer group phenomenon in that we test a theory called homophily. This will be the word of the day, homophily. Birds of a feather flock together. Many of you probably remember being an adolescent and your mom saying, I don't like when you hang out with Leah O'Rourke. That was my friend that my mom didn't like. She's like, you're just different when you're around Leah O'Rourke. Mom had no idea how different I was around Leah O'Rourke, right? She was a bad influence and still is. I see her on Facebook and I have like nightmares coming back to me and bad decisions I made because of her. She was a bad influence. That's homophily. Birds of a feather flock together and you socialize one another. And in bullying, we know the homophily hypothesis fits beautifully for bullying. You could be a great kid, even come from a Catholic background, and start hanging out with that wrong person in sixth grade. By the end of sixth grade, you could be that big bad bully too. It's a peer group phenomenon. Only one program addresses the peer norms. Most of our programs address the individuals and not the shifting or those very influential leaders that we have in our schools. None of the programs address family or community violence. Most of these programs are universal and primary in nature. We need much more secondary and tertiary programs if we're going to stop this problem. Because remember, in many of our schools and many of the schools you're in, you have kids now that are being raised by kids. Teenage pregnancy rate, despite the abstinence movement that we had, is high. Okay? That's a whole nother talk about this. And it doesn't help those two programs, 16 and pregnant, and the other one, I don't know what that is, but I watch it when I'm folding clothes thinking this is field research. I must understand what the kids are watching around teenage pregnancy. All programs fail to address the extent to which demographic variables and implementation. This is key. For us in our randomized clinical trial, we see variability in implementation. We actually show up and watch you teachers, see if you're implementing. Do we want you to do it scripted? No, certainly not. Do we want you to be creative? Yes. Do we want you to try to implement the lesson? Yes. Do you all? No. Do I have $10 million to watch every lesson? No. But I show up like a social worker randomly. I catch you off guard. Oh my gosh, she's here. Yes. So we need to know. There's implementation will vary. If you want sustainability and scale up, it is going to vary. We also have to recognize that teachers may not like some of this curriculum. They might find it different. So how can we have a feedback loop from teachers to have a conversation about what works for them and under what context? We also have to recognize for the bullying prevention programs that have been adopted in Europe that although their immigration patterns are changing in Norway and Finland, the bottom line is that they do will never resemble what we have in our schools. One of my intervention schools, there's 47 languages spoken. You see the change, and the change is drastic. We don't need the census report to tell us that there's certain ethnic groups that are increasing in numbers, and with those ethnic groups, although variability, there will come different expectations from families, different expectations placed on teachers, and we have to get in front of this. I think we've run all a little bit of denial of this. We have to get in front of this and understand how it is that kids' behaviors are directly tied to the cultures in which they're situated. In a bullying prevention program that was adopted in Norway, where the Ministry of Education said there will be a countrywide bullying prevention program, where the teachers are like, yes, we're on board, is very different than teachers now that say, oh my gosh, the U of I researcher, what do you want from me? I slide them a check, it helps. You know, a little check, a little gift cards and stuff like that. But it's very different. We also are in a culture in which teachers, unfortunately, do not have the prestige that they have in Europe. Many of you probably have been, say, to an Asian country where the parents of the children bring food to the teachers. Presents. Right? We have to recognize that there has to be a systemic change, and it has to happen at a national level. I wasn't going to depress you, but I just spent 3 days in D.C. on the Hill, where, from all accounts, education is being attacked brutally. I'll give you an example. We're thinking about shutting down the National Science Foundation directorate that houses most of the education research. National Science Foundation directorate. They are blaming teachers for everything on the Hill. That is real. What I want to tell you, though, and leave you with today, is that you can do nothing about. That, certainly you can write your Congress and Senate, we're waiting it out at so many levels, it's unbelievable. But your day-to-day work that you do with the kids makes a difference. We didn't have time today to talk about the resiliency work that we do. In our work, many of the kids that are bombarded with homophobic bantering, that are chronically victimized because they have a disability, that are ostracized for whatever reason within the context of the schools, those kids that have a relationship with one teacher that is positive, they have fewer negative outcomes than those kids that don't. At the end of the day, I always say, whatever hotel I'm at or wherever I am, what did I do today to make a difference? It's bigger for you because you have 22 to 25, 27 kids looking at you. If you're middle school kids, probably 150 kids you've seen in that day. Did you make a difference? Are there kids that, for whatever reason, may not have the personality and the attractive attributes that draw you to them? Because we are human. Are there kids that you avoid? Reach out to those kids. Because if you're avoiding them, others are avoiding them. And it does feel good to go after that same kid that, you know, smiles back at you. Resiliency is real. We feel it. But the very kids that push you away, they're pushing you away because most adults have failed them. Don't be that next adult to fail a child. So let them figure it out in D.C.
They're an absolute disaster. The reality is you have a big career ahead of you. This is an awesome career. Think about what you're doing. You don't need validation from those parents to know what you're doing. Push your administration to be strong administrators. We will work at the national level to make sure that principals and administrators run their building and are not dictated by the parent groups. Not that they shouldn't have a voice and be involved, but they shouldn't be dictating the curriculum and the work that we do with kids. Hopefully we can talk. This will go on next year. I'll have some results on the pre-post randomized clinical trial, and we can talk more about a social-emotional learning framework. The key is bullying prevention must go beyond giving kids definitions and putting posters on the wall and singing to the kids. I love a song. I love a dance. But it's not going to change the climate and culture in your school where those kids are faced with violence and disrespect outside of that school all the time. I did not get very far, and I apologize for that. 1 hour is just not very short. But I'm going to stop there for questions.